It was only until the collapse of the Ottoman Empire that these documents were suppressed. Memory of them, you know, disappeared among Muslims. It was, it was colonialism and imperialism and so on that repressed them and crushed them and subverted them.
Welcome to Crossing Faith. Today, we are very, very lucky to have Dr. Moreau on the podcast, who is the author of a book that I use all the time, The Covenants of the Prophet Muhammad with the Christians of the World, but is a world-renowned professor and scholar, academic, and we're very, very lucky to have him here today. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Moreau.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
Maybe you could just tell us a little bit about your background. You're Muslim and originally from Canada, but live in the States now. But maybe you could tell us a little bit about, you know, how you came to Islam and how the focus of your life has been religious scholarship and engagement on behalf of the Muslim community.
Well, we could start with my early childhood, but I'll skip all of that. But I was always very spiritually inclined. And we can jump around to the age of 13. That's when I started my intense study of religion in general. I was truly a seeker of the truth. And I realized that truth was not found just in a single tradition, but I was seeking for truth in multiple traditions at the time. And so I endeavored to study all of the scriptures. I studied, I was 13 years old. I read the entire Bible, but I didn't stop there because I knew there was all kinds of non-canonical gospels and apocryphal gospels and Gnostic gospels and so on. So I studied, I wanted like, you know, who is Christ? Who was Jesus? Is it this Jesus of the New Testament that we currently have? I was looking for the historical Jesus. I wanted the full spectrum of opinions on Jesus Christ. And so I studied all of the lost books of the Bible. I studied Hindu scripture, Buddhist scripture, every religion under the sun, the entire section on religion in my local public library. And finally, I came across the Quran, and I was deeply moved. I was profoundly impressed. It was clearly a literary masterpiece. A spiritual masterpiece. And I said, wow, this resonates with me profoundly. Because fundamentally, I've always been a monotheist. That's my nature. I believe in one God. And so, obviously, that closed certain doors and so on. I mean, if you believe in one God, if you're a strict monotheist, what are your options? Well, your right. options would be Judaism. I'm not a Jewish person. There's a racial, ethnic component to all of that. And also, I believed that Jesus was indeed a prophet and a messenger. So that had to be a part of my worldview. Hinduism wasn't for me, but I could relate to the Brahmins and so on, the early Hindus who were monotheistic, who said that God has many names, but the wise call him one. So yes, there was truth there. The wise call him one. There, you know, for the Hindus, everything is a manifestation of God and so on. But to me, I was interested in that one. By the time I reached 16, I decided that this is what I am. I didn't really view it as a conversion, changing from one thing to another, a sense of realization of who I was. So the Quran, of course, is what brought me into Islam. And go ahead.
And so you're at 16, it's called a revert. We're all Muslims, right? One way or another.
Right.
And the idea of going through this sort of faith journey of popping around to different traditions and understanding them. You mentioned Jesus at the beginning of the conversation and a number of times. What was the pivotal element of the Quran and Islam that put you over the edge and said, this is who I am and what I'm about? Was it Hazrat Isa? Was it just the journey, or what's the component, that key element where you said, this is who I am and what I'm about, and I'm going to live this faith?
Well, no, it didn't boil down to just Jesus. I thought that the Quran was much closer to the historical Jesus that I had studied about. It was the belief in one God and moral and ethical values.
I always say the Quran is a way to live. It's basically 97% of how to live.
Yes, and fortunately, one of the earliest, one of the earliest traditions I came across during, those early years was the Ashtiname, the Ahad al-Nabi, the covenant of the Prophet Muhammad with the monks of Mount Sinai. So again, I'm Quran-centered. Well, I'm God-centered first. Then I'm Quran-centered. And then the first teachings of the Prophet Muhammad per se that I was exposed to was the Sinai Covenant, this treaty that he made with the monks from the monastery of St. Catherine's at Mount Sinai in what is now Egypt. And I looked at this document. Now, the thing is, there are some people that have been Muslims for 50, 60, 70, 80 years, and they've never heard of these documents, and they come across them, and some people say, no, it must be, it must be a forgery. Or others say, wow, this is what I thought all along based on reading the Quran. And they say, I have no objections to this. This is what I believe in. This is my Islam. This is my Quran. So, again, so I come from, God, and then the Quran, and then the covenant of the Prophet. So this colored my vision of what Islam is or what Islam should be. Now, this is the early 1980s in Canada, before they started bringing in 500,000 immigrants every single year. I grew up in Brampton, and Brampton was a primarily, Christian, European community. Now, if you go to Brampton, or even you go to Toronto, it's very pluralistic. It's very diverse. There's mosques everywhere. There's halal restaurants. But my point is, back then, Muslims were very few and far between.
Right.
And so, I wanted to connect with people who shared my worldview. When I was 16, I was working for a gentleman who imported Persian rugs, and I was working with his company, and I asked him, are you Muslim? He says, yeah. And then I said, tell me about Islam, because I was already a Muslim in my heart. I hadn't taken my Shahada yet. And he told me, it's just a religion like any other religion. I said, okay. And he says, do you want to go to a strip joint? I said, dude, I'm 16 years old. He says, I can get you a fake ID. I said, I'm not it. That's not where I'm at, guy. This guy is in his 20s or 30s, and that's where he's at in his life. I said, no. And then finally, I found a mosque.
Right.
And I went to that mosque, and I came across these people, and something was wrong from the very beginning. Okay, I've explained this many times.
Right.
I was traumatized. I was shocked by the type of people I came across. Yes, at the mosque. And the people I befriended and so on. I soon came to realize that this was not the Islam that I believed in. This was not the Islam of the Quran. These people, unfortunately, were radical jihadists. Okay? All right. Now, many converts have gone through this. It's unfortunate. You can imagine someone, you know, let's say who's agnostic or atheist or whatever, and he reads the New Testament and he finds Christ and he embraces Jesus in his heart. And then he tries to seek out Christians seeking a community. And he comes across the Aryan Nation or he comes across the KKK. Now, I'm a Muslim. And I defend Muslims, okay? So I'm not lambasting or slandering Muslims or anything. Every community has its extremists, okay?
Sure.
You know, the Hindus do, the Buddhists do. You just have to look what they're doing in Myanmar, in Burma. Some of their extremists, but I'm not going to insult Buddhism because some extremist Buddhists are perpetrating genocide against the Muslims in Burma. I don't do that. There are Hindu fanatics who slaughter Muslims. I'm not dissing, you know, Hinduism. So, I want to clarify this. I mean, I've been accused of being a Muslim Islamophobe. Really? You know, I'm a self-hating Muslim. Give me a break. I mean, read my scholarship, read what I'm about. I am very critical, but I have a deep and profound love and attachment for God, the Prophet, and Islam. I just happen to be a very tolerant person. I'm not tolerant of extremists, though. So, you know, that was my experience. It was very traumatic. I never fully recovered from it. You know, I wish I had come across people, and there are plenty of people like us. Okay. There are plenty. And in fact, we are the majority of Muslims and you know, that lunatic fringe represents maybe 1% of the community, but this was during the war in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
And, I mean, all of the Western intelligence agencies were trying to encourage young Muslims to go fight in Afghanistan against the Russians. They were fueling and funding this ideology. And that's the Saudis have admitted it. They promoted it because they were told to do so by certain power brokers. Right. In any event, so I don't want to get too political, but we all know this story.
No, I understand. It's one of those things where you I've been involved in the multi-faith space for a long time and doing, you know, faith engagement. And I've been working with people for some time. And then all of a sudden they come around and they say something like, and I just came back from the International Religious Freedom Summit. And about a year ago, one of the key speakers there told me, you know, ISIS, they're Muslims. And there's a hadith and I can't go against what the hadith. And I said to her, it was really funny. I go, they're a doomsday cult. I said, once you violate the maxims of Islam, you could claim to be Muslim, but
sure.
You violated the maxims and that's it. You can't just go like accept everybody into the fold, particularly when the whole idea of Islam is a moral code, right? So, but a lot of this speaks to the beginnings, the book that I referenced in the beginning of the conversation, and that you say the catalyst was this covenant. It's like these covenants existed in the time of the Prophet. They were from the Prophet, peace be upon him, and now you have this book that is painstakingly researched. And going into chapter after chapter after chapter about these treatises, these covenants that the Prophet put in place with these different communities. And maybe it's a good transition to talk about it was a catalyst in you becoming Muslim, this idea of the first covenant with the monastery of St. Catherine, right? And then you would actually endeavor to put this book together to conduct the research. Maybe you could just talk to me a little bit about were you surprised at all the covenants that were out there? What did it take to actually chase these things down and put this book together? What was the process and really how did you come across when you discovered that all these covenants existed? What happened? How did this come together into the book that I use on a regular basis?
Yeah. So I'm in my early teens. I read the Quran. I read the Ashtiname or the covenant of the Prophet Muhammad with the monks of Mount Sinai, and those are my foundations. A few years later, I'm at university. It's my first semester there. I took a course on religion. And I proposed to write a my essay on jihad in Islam. All right. And so I write this essay. You know, the professor asked me, "Are you a Muslim?" And I said, "Yeah, yeah, I'm a Muslim." And he says, "Okay." In any event, in that essay, I quoted that Sinai covenant, that Ashkiname, and I get the essay back and he gave me an F. And I said, "Wow, well, maybe it's not a good essay." And, you know, so fine. Many years after, so I finished my bachelor's degree, my master's degree, my PhD. I've been a university professor for well over a decade. And I decide, you know, that maybe I should revisit this essay, Jihad in Islam. And then, you know, I clean it up a little bit, just, you know, a few little things. Essentially, it was 99% the same. I submit it for publication, peer-reviewed and everything. It gets published. And it was at that point I realized, in retrospect, I think that professor was an Islamophobe because my colleagues, my peers, blind peer review, they've accepted it for publication. All right. Now, so I cited that covenant in English. But at that time, after studying Arabic and so on, I wasn't just satisfied with translations. I wanted the original. All right. And so I saw a photo of it in a book and I contacted the editor of that book and I said, "Well, do you know where I can get an original copy? I'd like a picture of this in Arabic." And she says, "Well, why don't you ask Father Justin?" And at that point, I figured, oh, Father Justin sounds like probably like a Catholic priest in Boston. You know, maybe he traveled to Egypt, took a picture of it. And then so I email Father Justin. And I say, "Is there any way I can get a high-resolution copy of the Covenant of the Prophet?" And he said, "Sure, just let me go downstairs." And it was at that moment that it struck me that I was communicating with Father Justin of Sinai from the Monastery of St. Catherine in Egypt. He went downstairs. It's on display in their lobby. It's seen by millions of pilgrims and tourists every year. He took a picture of it, and he sent it to me. And I asked him, "Are there any other covenants of the prophet?" He said, "Absolutely. We have some in Simonopetra at the holy mountain of Mount Athos in Greek, and many other Christian denominations have copies of these documents." Now, obviously, by then I knew about the covenant with the Christians of Najran, because I was familiar. I'd been studying Islamic sources for decades. So, you know, I started with the Sinai Covenant, and then I found out about the Najran Covenant. Awesome. I found out about the covenant with obviously the Constitution of Medina, which was concluded with the Jewish community in Medina, when the messenger of God just, set up his city-state there. The other covenant with Makna. There were many other covenants and treaties in the Islamic sources. Now, of course, those were transmitted books from books from books from books going back. And now I'm looking at actually a manuscript that is 500 years old or say. And then it was a question of tracking down those documents. So I reached out to one of the monks at Mount Athos, and he was gracious enough to send me a copy of their Covenant of the Prophet, which is absolutely gorgeous. And eventually, I got in touch with all kinds of monks throughout the world. And that led me to travel extensively and to search for Covenants of the Prophet into libraries and archives and in patriarchates, in monasteries. After that, other scholars and academics and researchers joined me in this quest, notably Ahmed El-Wakil, who was based in Qatar at the time. He traveled to Egypt, visited many monasteries. He traveled to Greece. He traveled to Turkey, and we obtained covenants from there as well. I obtained some from Syria in the midst of the ISIS crisis. The ISIS had encircled their monastery. They wanted to destroy it, and precisely, specifically, they wanted to destroy the Covenant of the Prophet that they had there, that they had received from the messenger of God. And fortunately, they were able to put it in. They were able to safeguard it in another location, and they were moving it around. And so this is what we have. We have these ISIS people hunting down, you know, covenants of the Prophet in order to destroy them. You know, perhaps they don't want future generations to remember these documents or to refer to them. And we know in the past that some of these documents were destroyed by similar extremists. We don't deny that there have been extremists in the past. Some of them were religiously motivated. However, as we were discussing before we started this podcast, we have to distinguish between religion per se and spirituality and morals and values and ethics and so on, and empire and tribalism and racism, imperialism, colonialism, all kinds of factors that come into play. I mean, Christianity was the Jesus movement. It was a faith tradition. It was a very spiritual, ethical, moral, mystical movement. They used to free slaves. But then when it became the religion of the empire, well, then it becomes a totally different thing. The same thing. Are you going to blame Jesus for what the Spanish did, for the conquest of the Americas, the genocide of indigenous people, you know, forcibly converting millions of indigenous people? You don't blame Jesus or Christianity for that. There were all kinds of other motives. That people wanted land, people wanted money, people wanted booty. So we need to make some clear distinctions there. And so, fortunately, thanks to my research, thanks to the generosity and the kindness and the hospitality of the monks, and the Quran says that they are close to us because they're not arrogant, you know, they're pious and so on. So I came across these true Christians, you know, as they're described in the Quran, and they were very, you know, gracious towards me and to Ahmed al-Waqil and to other scholars who have been researching these documents. So we at the moment have at least 80 copies of these documents. These documents are from the 20th century, 19th, 18th, 17th, 16th, 15th, 14th, 13th. It keeps going back. Some of the earliest copies, are older than that, or references. We have references to the covenants of the Prophet in 7th century documents that are contemporary with the Prophet Muhammad and or the early rise of Islam and the spread of Islam. You see, our sources tend to be late. Some of them are 150 years old. I'm talking about Islamic books. Some are 300 years old, and others, you know, other books of hadith, some of them were compiled, you know, 1,000 years after the Prophet. But we have contemporary accounts, Christian accounts, in Armenian, in Syriac, in Greek, other languages that attest to the fact that the Prophet Muhammad granted covenants of protection to the Christians. All right. And so, you know, we have independent attestations. So we have all these verses from the Quran that we can refer to about protecting the people of the book and Christians and so on. We have the covenants of the Prophet in Islamic sources. We also have the covenants of the Prophet in Christian sources and actually manuscripts, right, that, you know, this was copied from the original covenant of the Prophet that was written down by the hand of Ali, that was dictated in the second year of the Hijrah and so on. So we have the names of this. So we have a paper trail. We have the scribes who did it. We can trace these back, okay? You know, it's one thing to say, like in a hadith, that so-and-so said, 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 that the Prophet said. That's very problematic for people to use a historical critical approach to religion, because they say, well, where's this guy and this guy and this guy? Where are their books? Where are their references? There's nothing tangible. There's no proof. You can't confirm this. That's not the case with these covenants of the Prophet. They have a chain of transmission that goes back. We know who the scribe was, who he copied it from, where the copy was. And these documents are remarkably consistent over the course of Islamic history. So anyhow, I'm sure there are more covenants of the prophet out there. So far, we have about 80 of them. That doesn't count the ones that I'm talking manuscript, 80 manuscripts. That doesn't count the versions we have in Christian literature and Islamic literature. I'm talking physical manuscripts. In terms of the letters, treaties, and covenants of the prophet, the issue was that they were scattered throughout Islamic sources. Okay, so they were found in books of biography, sirah, siyar books, traditions, ahadith, jurisprudence, fiqh, tafasir, Quranic commentaries. So it was kind of like looking for a needle in a haystack. Anyone who studied the hadith sciences understands that it's just like a massive ocean. All right. So fortunately, thanks to the works of Muhammad Hamidullah, who was a fantastic scholar, Hassan Shirazi, Ahmadi Miyanji, they've been collected in several volumes. Now, they are only available in Arabic, but, you know, thanks to my work, the work of Craig Considine from Rice University, Ibrahim Zain from Qatar, Ahmed al-Wakil and others, the Covenants of the Prophets are now accessible in English in over a dozen languages. And nice. These documents were recognized and they were acknowledged by the Umayyads, the Abbasids, the Fatimids, the Ayyubids, the Mamluks, the Safavids, and the Ottomans. So they played a central role in the domestic policy of the Ottoman Empire and also their foreign policy. There are actually volumes and volumes of covenants between the Ottoman Empire and the French, and the Ottoman Empire, and the English, and the Ottoman Empire, and all kinds of other Christian nations, and so on. And if you look at the covenants that they concluded with their Christian allies in the West, they follow the same template of the covenant of the prophet. And so they're following a tradition. So this is the template that the prophet used. Like, you know, the introduction, the conclusion, the basic rights and principles and everything, they're following that tradition. And so they really took it to heart. Now, of course, the Ottomans weren't perfect. No one is perfect. But nonetheless, they strove to implement the covenants of the prophets with the Christians. I mean, after all, over 20% of the subjects of the Ottoman Empire were Christians. So that's a considerable number. The more we go back in history, the more we find that there were Christians. In Al-Andalus or Islamic Spain, Christians were the majority for centuries. It took centuries until maybe half of the Christians converted to Islam, and more centuries until maybe 80% of them converted to Islam. So this whole idea of forcible conversion, there's no basis whatsoever for that in Islamic history, in demographically and so on. This has been studied in the Levant, in like Palestine, Syria, Jordan, all of those areas there. Christians were the majority until the 12th century. In Egypt and northern Iraq, they were the majority until the 14th century. So obviously you don't have, the Muslims by and large, the first ones, of course, were the Arab Muslims. They were an Arab Muslim minority ruling over a Christian majority. Okay, we need to remind people of this. Language of the Umayyad Empire was not Arabic. It was Greek. Virtually all of the administrators were Christians, okay? Right. And these are Greek-speaking, Aramaic-speaking, or Syriac-speaking Christians. The Muslims were the political leaders and they were military leaders, but they left the administration to the Christians. It took many generations until the time of Abdul Malik, where he decided that we're going to make Arabic the official language and we're going to start building some walls between us and other communities. But during early Islam and during the early encounter between Muslims and Christians, the confessional boundaries were very fluid. They lived together. They shared sacred spaces. And so Muslims would go pray in churches. They would pray in monasteries. They would finance them. Christians likewise would participate in Muslim festivals and celebrations. There weren't walls between these communities. What is more, we had a minority of Arab men, all right, who spread out into the Middle East. They were not dragging harems of women with them. No, what do we find? We find that most of them intermarried. They married with Christian women, and hello, hello, we find that they did not forcibly convert their wives or expect them to convert to the faith. And that comes from the covenant of the prophet. It says that Christian women who are married to Muslim men will not be forced or coerced to embrace Islam, and that they will maintain the right to practice their faith. And right. So in one of the early Syriac sources, we have a case, all right? And Michael Penn mentioned this, that there was a Christian woman married to a Muslim man, and her priest refused to let her celebrate the Eucharist. And so the Muslim man went and he threatened to kill the Christian priest. He says, how dare you prevent my Christian wife from going to Mass simply because she is married to me, a Muslim man. And so this issue, these were issues that were debated among the Christians, all right? And so this is historical evidence that there were, that the covenants of the prophet existed. Not only that, that some people were very militant about right. about enforcing them. Okay, you must allow her to celebrate her Christian faith.
So how do you look at the criticism that these are just historical documents and they don't have relevance and it can't be operationalized or executed in real time in the present day? The idea that these are just relics of when Islam, the Muslim community, was engaging these the multi-faith communities. And you've spoken about how these were active communities throughout the Muslim world. But in the present day, when you're talking about ISIS trying to destroy these documents and eliminate them to control the narrative or create their own narrative, but when it comes to the critics that say that, oh, well, this is just a nice historical book, but none of it is relevant today because of the global interpretation of what Islam is from a media standpoint. What would be your response to something like that?
Those people are very myopic. They're just focusing on specific events. They're not looking at the past 1400 years of history. There were cases where there were excesses. There were cases where Assyrians were massacred or Armenians were massacred. But by and large, over the past 1400 years, the principles of these covenants were applied by various rulers. It was only until the collapse of the Ottoman Empire that these documents, were suppressed,
and right,
that memory of them, disappeared among Muslims. It was, it was colonialism and imperialism and so on that repressed them and crushed them and subverted them. So we have a long history. And if you look at Christian accounts of Islam, you will find them saying during that, not only do the Muslims not persecute us, but they honor us and they cherish us and they protect our institutions. Exactly what the covenant of the prophet says, that not only do they have the right to life and freedom of religion, but that that Muslims have the duty to protect the religious institutions and their churches and their monasteries. And not only that, if they fall in disrepair, they're responsible to repair them and fix them and keep them in good shape. So this is the true tradition. Now there is a counter tradition to that. So I'd like to just mention something known as the Covenant of Umar.
Great.
Now there is a Covenant of Umar, Which is basically, it's almost identical to the covenant of the prophet, which says everything. They have the right to life, freedom of religion. They have the right to ring their bells and their celebrations and so on. It's just like the covenant of the prophet. We have this in Islamic sources. We also have it in early Christian sources, okay? Very, very, very early. And then centuries after the fact, there's another document that appears, and academics and scholars refer to it as the pseudo-covenant of Omar, or the covenant of pseudo-Omar. It's attributed to Umar, okay, the caliph, the second caliph. Some people think that it was misattributed to him, and it's something that was introduced by Umar the second. And this one is the exact opposite of the covenant of the prophet. All right, that they do not have the right to ring their bells for mass, that they don't have the right to conduct processions, that they have to wear like distinct clothing. So and the covenants are right giving, and the covenant of Omar, the original one, gives right, but this fake covenant of Omar suppresses rights. Okay, it's like someone took the covenant of the prophet and the covenant of Umar, and Abu Bakr also renewed the covenant of the prophet, and he insisted again on all those major points. But somewhere down the road, someone sat down and rewrote the whole thing and flipped everything around. So it's right. Now, instead of you have this right, this right, this right, you don't have this right, you don't have this right, you don't have this right, and so on. And we find that this list of restrictions keeps growing over the centuries. And so this so-called covenant of pseudo-Omar, you know, it was small and then it's medium and then it gets longer and then it's like pages of restrictions against Christians. So there were some jurists who felt very threatened by the fact that Christians were still the majority at that time. You know, they thought that they were like fifth columnists, that they could ally with the Byzantines or with the Armenians or other people or so on. And we had to repress and contain these people. Now, curiously, though, you know, you can't just believe what you read somewhere. Like some Islamophobes and Christian fundamentalists will take this fake covenant of Umar and say, ha-ha, that proves that Muslims were repressing Christians and so on. But you have to go and see, well, what does archaeology tell us? What does history tell us? What do other sources tell us? I mean, just because it's written down doesn't mean it's true. And so maybe these jurists, some of them, who were very intolerant, were coming up with these lists of restrictions. When we look at the situation on the ground, we find that it's the same, okay? Yeah. That churches are not being destroyed, they are being built, all right? Actually, the greatest increase in the construction of churches takes place under Islamic rule. So they were thriving under these people. So again, we have to look at the full picture. You know, it's like someone saying, well, you know, but we have people right now. I hear this a lot coming out of Russia. They're political scientists and so on, saying that, you know, should we really uphold human rights? Right? They don't apply anymore. They're just a tool of imperialism. And so maybe we should do away with them. So to me, when people say, the covenants of the prophet, the people of the book, the Ahl al-Zimma, these are relics of the past. We have people right now telling us that human rights are relics of the past. And I think we have to push back against that, because what kind of world will they offer us? What kind of world do we want to live in where you cannot, you know, criticize a war? You can't object to a war, without the threat of being, you know, deemed a traitor or thrown in prison or executed or sent to the front lines. No, again, I operate on the base. I'm a believer. I believe in God. And, you know, that's the first thing. And I believe in, you know, values and principles and ethics. You know, I believe in moral absolutism, that right is right and wrong is wrong, and it applies to all people in all places at all times. I'm not going to say that Muslim women have less rights than other people, or certain people have more rights or other, or that it's racialized and so on. You know, rights are rights. Okay, that's where we set the bar.
Well, I appreciate you unpacking that a little bit. I mean, there's such a criticism of there's the idea of people telling others what something is, and particularly with Islam, it's one of those things that's just commonplace. It's like, well, this is Islam, and I know this guy, but he's a good Muslim, or he's one of the good ones. Like everything else is, and the idea of having a history of documents and coupled with a lineage of action over the course of from the beginnings of Islam that where there's, it's not just one source, it's not just a Muslim source saying these things, it's the different communities that were flourishing, and there's historical evidence of all this stuff, shows that there's an identity that's very different than what's out there.
True.
What's being said.
Absolutely. Islamic Islamic sources written 300 years after the fact speak of battles and conquests and armies of tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands and cities falling. They describe a violent conquest of the surrounding areas. There is no basis whatsoever for that in archaeology. Ask any archaeologist who studied the region, there is no evidence of a violent conquest. All right. It is possible that Muslim armies approach cities. And we do have this in a lot of the narrations, that they came to the cities and they offered them a covenant. And right, that if they accepted the covenant, it was just a transition of administration. No one would be harmed. There would be no bloodshed. The rights of everyone would be protected. And so these accounts of like battles and so on that we find, you know, maybe this was appealing to some Bedouins looking back at their past, saying that, we're glorious warriors and so on. The evidence on the ground, the archaeological studies that have been conducted simply do not support that. What we have is a transition of power. And then people will say, well, how is it possible that, you know, a small number of Arab Muslims in the 7th century were able to conquer two of the greatest superpowers of the time, the Byzantium and the Sassanid Empire of the Persians? Right. But hold on, back up a bit. They had just finished, okay, a world war. The Christians, the Jews, and even the early Muslims believed that it was the time of the eschaton, that the day of judgment was coming, the world was ending. It was a horrific war between Byzantium and between the Persians. And just as that finishes, the Muslims come up and they spread Islam and they conquer all these territories. Well, to me, from a military point of view, from a strategic point of view, I'm talking economics, I'm bringing all the factors together. I mean, it's like creating, you know, it's the end of the, they just finished slaughtering each other. They were completely exhausted. Their military was depleted. They were all demoralized, right? And just when they thought that it was over and they're standing among ashes and rubble and so on, some other people come and they say, you know what? Here you go. Take the city. We've had enough of this. All right. So, you know,
And then you have the Fourth Crusade peppered in there, you know, the one that went to Constantinople and decided to go have a,
and, and so, which, A lot of those Christians who were stationed there in the Middle East, in like, you know, what's now Palestine and Israel and so on in Jerusalem, they said, you know what? I'm just going home. I'm retreating. I haven't been paid for months. Actually, I haven't been paid in years. Okay. I'm just going back to France or Italy or wherever I came from. You know, let these people have, you know, take over. And the funny thing, too, is that according to the early Christian accounts, these Muslim armies were filled with Jews. They were also filled with Christians, but they say that they were heretical Christians. So maybe they were Nestorians, maybe they were Arians, maybe they were Judeo-Christians. But the Byzantines were not very popular. They had just forcibly converted all of the Jews. They had been persecuting everyone. They claimed that, you know, the empire is Orthodox, and anyone who doesn't follow our understanding of Christology or theology is a heretic and apostate. And a lot of those groups were on the fringes of the empire, and some of them had settled in Arabia, and they made common cause with Muhammad and the early Muslims, right? Yes, so, you know, yeah. Common cause. Well, we have a common enemy. And even in the Crusades and so on, we find the Christians of the Middle East, the Christians of the Muslim world, fighting in Muslim armies against European Christian crusaders, right? And they describe, the Muslims describe them that these are our brothers. And the Christians said, these are our brothers. We are one people. You're Christians, we're Muslims, these guys over here are Jews, but this is our land, we are one people. Now again, for a Christian at the time, now, let's say, you know, you were, you didn't follow, like, Orthodox Christianity. Do you want to be ruled by the Byzantines who were persecuting you and burning your holy books and so on? Or you have people here who we have slightly different beliefs. Our belief in God is strictly monotheistic. We don't believe in trinities and so on, but we do love Jesus. We believe he was a prophet. We believe he was a Messiah. We believe in the virgin birth. We revere Mary. See, we agree on all of these points, and we will protect you. And your Christian overlords from Europe, they didn't protect you. Okay, we will protect you. The same thing with the Jews. These Byzantines, they forcibly converted you. Go back to your religion. We love Moses, okay? Three-fourths of the Quran relates stories from the Old Testament. Okay, sure. Three-fourths. And one of the most one of the characters that's mentioned the most often in the Quran is Moses and Moses and Moses, all right? So right. We respect you, and we will protect you. So this is how you make allies, and you make common cause against a common enemy. And I think, you know, this is a message that we need to learn in our day and time.
No, it's a profound just statement that you just made. It's like, we have these, we know who we are and what we're about, right, as a Muslim community. And it's here, not only from a historical perspective, but it's documented. I mean, I always say to my friends, well, one thing about Islam is we know that the prophet existed. We know the people around him. We know the jurists over the years. And the idea is that we can verify and re-verify what has happened and what was said. And there's a process. It's a very, very tight process to get to establish a hadith, for example, and Islamic law has been arbitrated over for years. So for hundreds of years. So the idea of us of an outcome has been pined over because someone came up with this problem. And sure enough, the religious scholars debated it and came out. I guess one of the, I know we're kind of getting out there in time, but I wanted to kind of ask you, is there a burning desire? Is there a covenant that's out there that you know existed or that you've heard of that you're pursuing right now and you haven't located it and you're kind of going, we've been working on this for years. Is there sort of a Raiders of the Lost Ark search going on for something that speaks to the covenants of the prophet?
Sure. I continue with my research. Several other academics are continuing with the research. We're regularly finding new manuscripts. And of course, we're dating them and we're tracking the transmission of these documents. We know there are many more out there. And so, yes, it's kind of like an Indiana Jones quest in which many parties are involved. There are other people out there conducting research that aren't necessarily looking for these documents, but may find evidence that supports them. For example, one of the earliest Islamic inscriptions in the Holy Land, which was carved on stone, speaks about the protection of God and his messenger, right? The zimma of Allah and the zimma of his messenger. And so not only were these things written down, you know, on papyri and so on, but they were engraved in stone. So there is, I believe this one is in Jerusalem, where it is actually written in stone by Muawiyah, I believe, and it's referencing the covenant of the prophet. And so there are teams out there. There's a French team that's been conducting epigraphic research throughout Saudi Arabia for decades, and they've published all kinds of fascinating finds. And there are also amateur people, like some of the greatest discoveries now are appearing on Twitter. You have some young Saudis and so on who are using drones or going out in jeeps, and they're climbing the mountains. They're going to inaccessible places and they're taking pictures of, and this is the incredible thing, there are Arabic inscriptions throughout Arabia, throughout Jordan, throughout Syria, all the way up to North Africa and Morocco. These things, some of them are pre-Islamic. Some of them, you know, go back thousands of years. And they're in the languages of, you know, the Southern Arabs and so on. I'm talking just the early Islamic inscriptions. I mean, there are thousands upon thousands of them, all right? Verses of the Quran and so on. And I wouldn't be surprised if we found some of these inscriptions that support the covenants of the prophet or allude to them in some way. So this is really a fascinating time in which to live. There was a time where archaeological work was not permitted in Saudi Arabia, and I would commend the leadership there for opening that up and allowing scholars to, we shouldn't be afraid of our history and our past. Okay. Nobody is ever going to change the fact that we believe in one God and we believe in the messenger of God. You know, our basic creed is unaffected. I mean, we might tweak something here or there in the historical record to make it more accurate. But, you know, the fear that certain people had in the past that these discoveries are going to make, you know, the edifice of Islam crumble apart, it's just preposterous. It's ridiculous. You know, do you really think our faith is that weak? It isn't. Okay. I'm not afraid of the historical critical methodology. I'm not afraid of archaeological research. Nothing is going to make me stop believing that God is one and that Muhammad preached that God is one and that we should be just.
Right. It's not, I always say it's not that fragile, you know, that they
no, it isn't.
Confront and not we need to embrace whatever our history is, what's going on. But when we talk about some of these things like the covenants or we talk about our history as an empire, you know, there, we can talk about these things without referring to like slogans and,
sure.
and narratives.
I mean, you know, you have people out there, okay, Adam didn't exist. Okay, fine. Okay. You know, the flood, right? This didn't exist, and this person didn't exist, and Abraham didn't exist, and Moses didn't exist. You know, I don't care. That's not the point, okay? It's the moral lesson, okay? It's the moral lesson behind these stories that's the point. I mean, no one is disputing that Muhammad existed, obviously existed, Jesus existed. You know, many of these prophets existed. Do you really think that you're going to destroy my faith if you say, well, the story of Adam and Eve is mythological, right? It's just a story, an account of origins. It doesn't matter to me. Okay, it doesn't matter to me. And when people tell me, oh, well, the Quran was not written by God. Okay, or they tell me, I come from a literary background, and in literary studies we have a statement: the author is dead, right? Yeah. So we don't care about Cervantes, right? We care about Don Quixote, right? We care about the work. Right. So sure. to me, when they, some people, their faith trembles when some people say, well, some of this material could be, pre-Islamic. Some of it might be post-Islamic. It might have been the work of Muhammad and his scribes and so on. And people say, oh, my faith is under attack. I don't care about any of that. I love this book. It's absolutely beautiful. And that's what matters to me, the book and its message. That's that. I mean, to me, these are just, it's just futile.
Well, what a wonderful way to close the conversation. I appreciate you taking the time and talking about not only the idea of the Quran and how profound it has been to you, but the idea that we have history behind the faith in action throughout the centuries. And this, like I said, this book I use almost all the time with some of the faith communities I interact with. And your commentary, your comments, your candor in this conversation, I appreciate it very much. Thanks so much, Dr. Moreau. I appreciate you taking the time.
Well, alhamdulillah. Thank you for having me on.